The book of Obadiah that we had just read for us is directed toward the nation of Edom. Edomites are related to the Israelites through Abraham. Edom descends from Esau, and the Israelites descend from Jacob. Neither nation was really fond of each other. They usually, though, managed to live peacefully next to each other. When Israel fell, though, because of their sins, Edom didn't make any overt move against them. If you go back and look at Obadiah, in Obadiah, starting at verse 10, it says, "Because of the violence of your brother Jacob, you will be covered with shame, and you'll be cut off forever. On the day you stood aloft, on the day the strangers carried off his wealth, and foreigners entered his gates, and lots cast for Jerusalem, you too were as one of them. Do not gloat over your brother's day, the day of his misfortune. Do not rejoice over the sons of Judah in the days of their destruction. Yes, do not boast in the day of their distress. Do not enter the gate of my people in the day of their distress. Yes, do not gloat over their declamity in the day of their disaster, and do not loot their wealth in the day of their disaster. Do not stand at the fork of the road and cut down their fugitives, and do not imprison their survivors in the day of their distress." Edom did not actively, straightforward work against Israel. They just didn't support Israel. They didn't directly attack them, but they did covertly aid the Babylonians. They gave basically reports to the Babylonians telling them where the Jews were hiding out. You know, they kept the Israelites from escaping. They plundered the empty cities that the Babylonians left behind. And they rejoiced in Israel's defeat. You know, at a time when kin should have stood by kin, when treaties should have been honored, when neighbors should have bound together, the Edomites remain neutral. You know, consider their ancestor, Abraham, their common ancestor. When Lot was carried off to war, even though Lot and Abraham had a disagreement, they couldn't live within the land, they went their separate ways, yet when Lot was carried off in a war, Abraham did not stand by. Instead, he gathered an army and rescued Lot. In fact, take a look at Genesis chapter 14. Genesis chapter 14 and in verse 16. He says, "Brought back all the goods and also brought back his relative Lot with his possessions, and also the women and the people." It didn't matter what the past was like. What mattered was that they needed help. And Abraham was able to give that. And yet his descendants could not do the same. Israel was in trouble and Edom just stood by and watched it happen and basically rejoiced, saying, "Glad they got it." They wanted to see Israel ruined. In fact, in Micah chapter 4 and in verse 11, it says, "And how many nations have been assembled against you who say, 'Let her be polluted. Let our eyes gloat over Zion.'" Israel was not popular among the other nations because Israel stood out. Israel followed God, technically, while the other nations followed their own gods. And so a lot of the other nations were quite happy to see Israel take a blow. The reason why I'm bringing this up is that if we look at our nations, you know, violent crimes are happening in increasing frequency. And too many people just don't want to get involved. Now, Jesus told that parable about the Good Samaritan in Luke chapter 10. Luke chapter 10 and in verse 30. And Jesus replied and said, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among robbers, and they stripped him and beat him and went away, leaving him half dead. And by chance, a priest was going down by the on that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. Likewise, the Levite also, when he came to this place, saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan who was on a journey came upon him, and when he saw him, he felt compassion, and came to him and bandaged up his wounds, pouring oil and wine on them. And he put him on his own beast and brought him to an inn and took care of him. On the next day, he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper and said, take care of him, and whatever more you spend, when I return, I will repay you. Which of these 3 do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers? And he said, the one who showed mercy toward him. Then Jesus said to him, go and do the same. Notice we got the priest, we got the Levite. Neither one caused the man's harm. They didn't rob him, they didn't beat him, but they passed him by. They didn't help. So many people don't feel obligated to help those who are in need. No, friends should be there for in times of trouble. That's one of Job's complaints against his friends. They came and came and accused him of committing some type of grievous crime. And Job told them in Job chapter 6 and in verse 14, for the despairing man, there should be kindness from his friends, so that he does not forsake the fear of the Almighty. My brothers have acted deceitfully like a wadi, like the torrents of the wadis which vanish, which are turbid because of ice and into which the snows melt. And when they become waterless, they are silent. When it is hot, they vanish from their place. The paths of the course winds along, and they go up into nothing and perish. The caravans of Tema looked, the travelers of Sheba hoped for them. They were disappointed, for they had trusted. They came there and were confounded. When things are going bad, you expect to have somebody help you. You would hope that would happen. But Job's friends became unreliable, perhaps over fear of their own safety. Hey, if this happened to Job, we could be next. You know, when David was running for his life from Saul, David had no one to help him either. In fact, take a look at Psalms 142. Psalms 142. I'm going to start at verse 1. I cried aloud with my voice to the Lord. I made supplication with my voice to the Lord. I poured out my complaint before him. I declared my trouble before him. When my spirit was overwhelmed within me, you knew my path, the way where I walked. They have hidden a trap for me. Look to the right and see, for there's no one who regards me. There's no escape for me. No one cares for my soul. I cried out to you, O Lord, and I said, you are my refuge, my portion in the land of the living. Give heed to my cry, for I am brought very low. Deliver me from my persecutors, for they are too strong for me. Bring my soul out of prison, so that I may give thanks to your name. The righteous will surround me, for you will deal bountifully with me. Everything was going bad for David. And notice the complaint that he has before God. No one's there to help. No one's there to give aid. He feels like he's struggling all by himself, and no one cares. Though he knows God cares. In fact, he also mentions this in Psalm 38. Psalm 38 and in verse 10. My heart throbs, my strength fails me, and the light of my eyes, even this, has gone from me. My loved ones and my friends stand aloof from my plague, and my kinsmen stand afar off. What happens when somebody hits really hard times? Do we stand by and say, well, at least we didn't cause it? But a lot of times we need to get involved in it. We need to help, to give support. Now, God warns in Proverbs chapter 21. Proverbs 21 and in verse 13. He who shuts his ear to the cry of the poor will also cry out himself and not be answered. God will return to us exactly how we treat other people. There are going to be times when I need help. Have I been giving help to others? And we go to 1 John. John asks a very good question in 1 John chapter 3 and in verse 16. We know love by this, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. But whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him? Little children, let us not love with word or with tongue, but in deed and truth. How can we love God and want God's compassion for us if we're not willing to give compassion to our fellow man? You know, going back to Proverbs, ignorance is not an excuse. In Proverbs 24 and in verse 11, deliver those who are being taken away to death and those who are staggering to slaughter. Oh, hold them back. If you say, see, we did not know this. Does he not consider it who weighs the heart? Does he not know who keeps your soul? And will he not render to man according to his work? The idea of saying, well, I didn't know. I didn't realize it. God knows your hearts. He knows exactly what you really do know. Not what you claim to know. Sometimes we don't see things around us because we don't want to see. And it's more than just sympathy for those who are in trouble. We need to give help. In James chapter 2, James chapter 2, and in verse 13, for judgment will be merciless on the one who has shown no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment. What use is it, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but he has no works? Can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is without clothing and in need of daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and be filled, and yet you do not give them what is necessary for their body, what use is it? Now, he's using this to illustrate faith and works. But notice what the point still remains the same. What use is wishing somebody good, giving them sympathy, if you don't actually help? And the application is actually even greater. In Ephesians chapter 6, we're told that we're in a war. We're in a spiritual war against evil. In Ephesians chapter 6 and in verse 10, finally be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the full armor of God so that you may be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in heavenly places. We're in a battle against Satan. And yet when some are overtaken by fault, do we stand back in neutrality? When someone is clearly slipping in their faith, when they're struggling against sin, do we just stand back and say, well, I hope you get better? Are we afraid to dirty ourselves by getting involved in helping somebody out of their sin? Take a look at Galatians chapter 6. And in verse 1, brethren, if anyone is caught in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, each one looking to yourselves, so that you too will not be tempted. And over in James chapter 5, we use this in our class this morning. James chapter 5, and in verse 19, my brethren, if any among you strays from the truth and one turns him back, let him know the one who turns a sinner from the error of his way will save his soul from death and will cover a multitude of sins. We need to bring people back out of sin. In a sense, it's the same problem that we talked about in class. So many people are willing to say, hey, I forgive the mass murderer from, you know, the school shootings or something like that. But nobody tries to change the mass murderer, to get him out of his sin. We need to bring people back. And sometimes with some people, we get to the point where we actually are kind of glad to see them taken down a notch or two. Instead of being saying, here's a person struggling with sin, they need help. Now we excuse ourselves, well, I didn't cause their downfall. And we congratulate ourselves, but neither did we prevent their downfall. Now we also find some people who are just neutral on truth. You know, like Pilate. As Pilate discussed things with Jesus, he became afraid. And in John chapter 18, and in verse 37, Pilate said to him, so are you a king? And Jesus answered and said, correctly you say that I'm a king. For this I have been born, and for this I come into the world to testify through the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. And Pilate said to him, well, what is truth? And then he walks away. He didn't stay for an answer. You see, some people are neutral about truth. They fold when they're opposed. They compromise in order to settle disputes. Yet the church is supposed to be the group that upholds the truth. In 1 Timothy chapter 3. 1 Timothy 3 and verse 15. But in case I am delayed, I write to you so that you will know how one ought to conduct himself in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and the support of the truth. The church is the support of the truth. You can't have truth and modify it. You can't change God's holy word and still have truth. No, we can't take middle-of-the-road positions on topics like abortion or homosexuality or sexual promiscuity or ethical issues. We can't alter the nature and the purpose of baptism or the character of the first century church or the being of God. We can't change those things and still have the truth. But yet a lot of people, we don't want conflict, we don't want disputes, and so we compromise. So that, well, we can at least get along with each other. But we no longer have the truth. There really is no neutral position. In fact, Jesus told us that we have to confess Christ. In fact, he said in Matthew chapter 12, Matthew chapter 12 and verse 30, "He who is not with me is against me, and the one who does not gather with me scatters." Now notice that, how he's worded that. If you're not with him, you're against him. You can't take a neutral standpoint. If you're not gathering, well, then he says you're just as, you might as well be scattering. Neutrality is to oppose Jesus. To not work for Christ is to destroy his efforts. See, when we talk about confessing Christ, it's a lifelong stand that we make. It's not just a one-time confession. It's what we do throughout our lives. In Romans chapter 10, Romans chapter 10, and in verse 8, "But what does it say? The word is near you, in your mouth and in your heart. That is the word of faith which we are preaching. And if you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe with your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For with the heart a person believes, resulting in righteousness, and with the mouth he confesses, resulting in salvation." It's not a matter if we confess. It's when we do it. It's not just a one-time thing. It's something we have to do throughout our lives. There are times when people will bring up sinful things in the workplace. Do we take a stand saying, well, that's not right? Or do we just keep silent and say, well, I don't want to cause any problems? Oh, you know, the workplace doesn't allow discussion of religion. Is that what Christians should do? See, in Philippians chapter 2, Philippians chapter 2 and verse 9, "For this reason also God highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name which is above every name, so that the name of Jesus every knee will bow, and those who are in heaven and those on earth and under the earth, and that every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of the Father." We will all confess Christ one day as we stand before him in judgment. In fact, in this war that we're in, this spiritual war, the outcome's already known. We know Christ is going to win. God has always won. The only outcome that's up to debate is, which side are you going to be on? And if you're not on the Lord's side, if you try to take a neutral position, then you're basically working for the enemy. You can't have it any other way. I hope you'll think about these things. If there's anyone here who's not yet a child of God, there's no better time than right now to put on Christ. For those who are children of God, would like the prayers of their brethren on behalf, why don't you come forward as we stand and sing the psalm that was selected.